Here we go with episode 7 of the Rooks and Beckards podcast, where folks who love books and records will find a fellow fan. My name is Ted, and this episode picks up on something my co-host John Young and I talked about in episode 6, The Death of Rock. In the books collection, I take a look at a 2018 bestseller by Stephen Hyden called Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. In records, it's Till Tuesdays, Everything's Different Now. Released in 1988, it's what I'd consider to be the band's best album, and, as it turned out, it was their last one. And then morning show host for 95.3 KUIC and a good friend of mine, John Young, he returns to talk with me about sex and drugs and rock and roll. John is also a part-time college professor who teaches a graduate course in human sexuality. So he'll bring his experience and knowledge to the proverbial table as we chew over this topic. First up, A Requiem for Classic Rock. Surveying the radio landscape in 2021, it's clear that classic rock is alive and well. The genre known for Two for Tuesdays or Get the Lead Out or Hump Day, and I'm sure there's a Rush Hour in there somewhere, has in the radio biz a very distinct image. If you're not familiar with that classic rock radio sound as you tune around the dial, it sounds a little something like this.
I like listening to music in the car.
Classic rock. Rock.
97.1 KLSX, the classic rock station.
Another classic rock block begins now.
It's nothing but classic rock all day.
Oh, yeah, baby.
KPGZ, classic rock radio.
Kansas City and all points in between.
It's a little odd that Stephen Hyden's Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock, seemed to hit all the right notes when it was published in 2018. Sure, that subtitle, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock, is pretty depressing, especially if, like me, you're a fan of the genre. However, what can be easily dismissed as a lament by an aging Gen Xer of lost youth or encroaching cultural irrelevance is, in Hyden's hands, more of a nuanced defense of the musical form. Hyden sidesteps many traps that could easily paint him as a dad rock enthusiast. Chapter after chapter, he knows that what is considered classic rock is a genre of music created almost entirely by white guys who co-opted the blues and made it louder and more aggressive. The genre was aided and abetted by a music industry made up mostly entirely of white guys who paid, often illegally with cocaine and cash, to have this type of music dominate the radio airwaves, which were run almost entirely by white guys. Add to that, you had concert promoters who were almost entirely white guys. Their business model was built on luring mostly younger white guys into arenas to see essentially heroic versions of themselves on stage. That kind of cultural dominance this particular variant of rock had on the culture is clear, with the terms of classic and rock kind of being fused together. Both terms imply a kind of permanence, even as the people who created the music are dying off with greater frequency these days. Hyden is absolutely aware of the kind of musical game rigging that's been going on since rock and roll started in the 1950s. But what he's presenting in Twilight of the Gods is that of a fan who could still find exhilaration, meaning, and relevance from a genre he loves, warts and all. And he does not go easy on classic rock when he wants to spotlight the warts, but he also enthusiastically sings its praises, even when highlighting bands who are more niche, like Phish, Wilco, or Weezer. What also makes Twilight of the Gods so powerful at times is the way in which Hyden weaves in biographical details about how, say, REO Speedwagon's High Infidelity reflected his mother's emotional reaction to her divorce, or how Fleetwood Mac's Rumours seemed to be the soundtrack that expressed what his father was feeling when the marriage fell apart. But where he really nails why his love of artists like Bruce Springsteen, The Who, Pink Floyd, and Bob Dylan means so much to him is because his parents' divorce left him without a father figure during those crucial teenage years. Those who stepped in as surrogate dads were his musical heroes, whose lyrics offered him a way to make sense of the world. Or, as he humorously wrote about Bruce Springsteen, "My own Springsteen neediness is borderline unhealthy. He's not merely my favorite rock star. My emotional ties are far messier than that. I'll put it this way. If you made a Venn diagram of Springsteen fans and people who have weirdly poisonous relationships with their fathers, I would be sitting dead center. Bruce didn't get along with his dad either. And like Bruce, we've all used Bruce Springsteen songs to work out our feelings about the old man. But it's not all daddy issues for Haydn. These detours into his own personal life aren't all that frequent in the book. Rather, he's more macro in the chapters that deal with the way in which, say, You Can't Always Get What You Want by the Rolling Stones morphed from a weary look at the end of the 1960s to being used by Donald Trump at campaign rallies to represent a white conservative status quo. Something similar happened in 1979 during Disco Demolition Night in Chicago, where 70,000 people came to a White Sox game to watch a DJ blow up piles of records. After the explosions, 5,000 drunken assholes stormed the field in a riot. Pat Benkowski, who was a freelance reporter at the time, reported what he saw at Kaminsky Park in 1979.
Many of the fans are scattering off the field now when they fight the police. And many Sox security numbers are joining the police, which are now about 40 or 50, and they're slowly, now rapidly, walking out the center field where the fire is burning. The fans are now streaming off the field in great numbers, and I doubt if very few will be left to confront the police as they come in helmets and nightstick gear.
The narrative after Disco Demolition Night came to represent a white conservative backlash against a music genre associated with blacks, Latinos, and gays. While rock fans were clearly angry as their place in the pop culture was being displaced by disco, rock musicians had a different view of the genre. Many of them liked it, or at least saw money-making potential by incorporating disco into their music. How else do you explain Kiss, the Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney, Rod Stewart, Blondie, and others recording hit singles that used elements of disco? It's clear that many musicians at the time were not tribal in their tastes, but it's also clear that whatever open mind they had about disco was not shared by many of their fans. Regarding tribalism, at one point in the book, Haydn summarizes Dina Weinstein, a professor of sociology at DePaul University. Weinstein's 1991 study, Heavy Metal, a Cultural Sociology, identified that race nor gender was a major factor in the culture of metalheads. Rather, there's a kind of tribalism at play where acceptance in the tribe is predicated on following certain codes, like how you dress, how you act, and how you express your love of music. Weinstein says that metal culture is, quote, exclusivist. Well, that may be the case, but many music subcultures share similar codes. Think of country music or hip-hop. Both genres are generally accepting of outsiders if they conform to the codes of conduct in their respective tribes. That exclusivist nature is the expression of what makes that culture or subculture unique and different from the mainstream. Rock is not all that different. It has codes, but because so many of its fans are older, they are less strict about those codes than their counterparts. Or to put it another way, it's a-okay for a guy in his 60s and 70s to show up to a country concert wearing a cowboy hat and boots. But if you're in your 60s and 70s and show up to a rock concert wearing the same stoner gear you wore in high school, you'll look like an idiot. Overall, I found Twilight of the Gods a really good read. I enjoyed Haydn's breezy style of writing, his humor, his analysis, and the conclusions he draws after taking his journey to the end of classic rock. Endings are rather sad affairs, and Haydn's tale, which is rather sad at times, ends by saying that all of this genre of music, like everything humans create, fades over time. As it fades, it's a reminder that we too face a similar fate. Instead of wallowing in the tragedy of its passing, he says, let's appreciate what we have while we can. Sure, classic rock artists are old people who probably phone in most performances, but every now and then, there will be performances or even new songs that are powerful reminders of the heroic roles rock stars played in the lives of kids from the heartland, from the cities, suburbs, and other places where they connected with the power of thundering guitars, rumbling bass, galloping drums, and a swaggering singer expressing life in the pure, transcendent moments of a song. In 1988, Boston-based Till Tuesday released their last album called Everything's Different Now. And to me, it was the best of the three records the band produced starting in 1985. Though their career as a band was short, Till Tuesday excelled in creating songs that centered on failed or rocky relationships. Credit lead singer and songwriter Amy Mann for mining that emotionally charged terrain. How else can you explain the success of Voices Carry, based on her crumbling relationship with drummer Michael Houseman? Their second album, Welcome Home, had similar drama tucked into almost every lyric. However, by the time the band went into the studio to record 1988's Everything's Different Now, it wasn't just romantic relationships that had crumbled. The band was starting to fall apart as well, with only three members from the original lineup left. But Mann was also coming off another breakup with songwriter Jules Shear, and starting another one with her touring guitarist John Bryan, another songwriter who would go on to help Fiona Apple vault into the mainstream. Oh, the drama of rock and roll. But that's the drama that can make for great songs, and it does on Everything's Different Now. And to me, the 10 songs on this record make it close to a minor masterpiece. Yeah, it's that good, especially from a band that wasn't together for very long. Many artists rail against their labels. They find the people who run them abhorrent, greedy, controlling, and soul-sucking at times. And that was the case for Mann's relationship with Epic Records, or so Mann recounts in an interview with Stereo Gum when she said, "The record company was wildly uninterested because in a kind of classic form, a new A&R guy had come in. He didn't like anything the other A&R guys did, and he was like, there's a new sheriff in town, and he just immediately scuttled the record. I remember we suggested to the record company, we were like, it's kind of acoustic guitar songs, so why don't we go around to radio stations and play songs on the acoustic guitar? And they were like, no, nobody does that. That's unheard of. And of course, like, you know," and then Stereo Gum adds, "This was literally 1 year before MTV Unplugged launched, and everyone was doing acoustic performances all the time." Mann continues, "We couldn't get the label to do anything. They were really uninterested. I remember talking to radio stations, and they were like, oh, you have a new record out? The record company didn't even send it to us. They wouldn't even put it in the fucking mail." Well, that's not exactly true, as I can attest that an adult contemporary radio station my brother worked at in 88 did play the lead single, Believed You Were Lucky, quite a lot. Well, until it fell off the charts. But whether by design or accident, the move by the band to brighten up the sound worked. The music was more lively, the hooks were more hooky, and the overall sound of the album was certainly more commercial. Just take the title track with the opening guitar riff, followed by a very polished sound as the first verse starts. Mann may have been a bit leery about the direction of the band's sound, but I loved it. Credit her ex, Jules Shear, and Matthew Sweet for penning the album opener. Rip in Heaven, like, well, every other song on this record, is about a failed relationship. But what I love about the song is the way Mann phrases her vocals, especially on this part. Great stuff, and it makes for a great transition into the lead guitar solo. And speaking of great stuff, the next track, Why Must I, is one of those pure Amy Mann confessionals where the pain of a breakup leads to a lot of self-examination and more than a whiff of codependency when she wonders, why must I take it so hard? Other people get by with either bourbon or God, but my world became this one boy. It's the way that I'm made. Do you think I enjoy it? And I want to take a moment to talk briefly about the contributions that guitarist Robert Holmes and keyboardist Michael Montes made to this record, especially on this song. Montes really does most of the heavy lifting with the hooks, while Holmes does a wonderful job by adding tasteful accents towards the end of the song. J for Jules is about Jules Shear, but it's also about a breakup that Rivals Coming Up Close, which was off of Welcome Home. Believed You Were Lucky, the first single off the record, and I talked about it earlier. It was released in two forms. One on the album, and then there was this censored version that the radio stations played. But it's the uncensored version that really shines, if only for the final words in the chorus. It was co-written by Shear, and the song shows the kind of obsessive reflection that goes on post-breakup, going over and over what it was that just crumbled the whole relationship. Limits to Love and Long Gone Buddy continue with variations of the album's central theme. However, on the other end of the telescope, which was co-written and has co-vocals by Elvis Costello, that song really stands out as one of the most lyrically interesting ones on the record. Granted, the tempo is a bit plodding at times, but Costello's cynicism is front and center towards the end with lyrics like this.
And though your response always works, your necktie never fits. Now it's so hard to pick the receiver up, and when I call, I never noticed you could be so small. But the answer was under your nose.
Elvis Costello released his own version of the song in 1996 on All This Useless Beauty that was, far more bitter than what he penned with Amy Mann in 1988. The record wraps with Crash and Burn and How Can You Give Up, and ends on a fitting note. Fitting in that it reflects what Till Tuesday excelled in, doomed relationships. Mann would go on to record many successful and not-so-successful solo records after Everything's Different Now became Till Tuesday's swan song. The album also shows Mann's growing confidence as a singer-songwriter, and she agrees. In that same Stereo Gum interview I recounted earlier, she said, quote, "I do think I was getting better. I think probably I would have liked the album to sound a little different, a little less 80s, but once again, it was hard to get away from that sound. And it was hard for me to articulate what I wanted because I didn't really know anything about production." I get it. The work you create when you're just starting out can be a little cringy when you revisit it. But it is unfortunate that Mann doesn't feature more of these songs in her solo sets because the material is so strong and it still holds up decades later after it was released. There's no doubting that these songs are some of the strongest the band recorded in their short history. And it's something that shouldn't be buried with the past.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll is all my brain and body need.
Ian Dury and the Blockheads summed it up in 1977 with the lyrics Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. And there's something to that combination that makes it more than just a stereotype. Co-hosting with me again in this segment of the Rooks and Beckards podcast is John Young. Hello, John.
Feeling sexy. Thank you so much, Ted Asregato. It is great to be back with you again.
Now, folks, John is a man of many talents. He hosts a morning show on 95.3 KUIC. He's a musician. He's also a professor, not of rock and roll, though he is that. No, John teaches a graduate level course, actually courses, in human sexuality, because apparently it seems there aren't enough hours in the day. We're going to talk about sex and sexuality in rock and roll or rock music because it's such an important part of the culture of rock and really other popular music. So to kickstart the conversation, John and I went right for the hardcore stuff. That's right. And I hope, you know, our spouses aren't really listening to this right now, but we both read a 2017 article in Human Ethology Bulletin. I know. Okay. Most people look at that scholarly journal for the pictures, but we read an article called Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, Evidence Supporting the Storied Trilogy by a couple of professors, Marissa Harrison and Susan Hughes. First off, I had to look up what the hell is ethology. I consider myself, you know, not a
You're not a dumb man, Ted Estragado, by any stretch. Don't make me start to list your, you know, your
CV.
Your CV. Thank you. Yeah, I lost a lot. You're not your resume, but the fancier version of that. Yeah, it was a very interesting article. And I don't want to stop you with your train of thought there, but
I was just gonna quickly explain what ethology is because I didn't know.
Well, I didn't either. So explain it to me. Yeah, please.
It's very, very simply, it's the study of animal behavior. So when you put the term human in front of ethology, it becomes the study of human behavior. So that's what they do. And that's what the article is about, a study of human behavior with sex and drugs and rock and roll. So, but John, you're a professor of human sexuality, which is a study of a part of human behavior, right? So these professors are saying that there's a good amount of evidence showing a connection between sex and drugs and rock and roll.
This is a deep dive article. These two were not messing around when it came to their level of their depth of study of this. It sounds very trite on the surface, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, this, you know, this trilogy of, you know, amazingness, but they break it down in a way that does make you stop and think, okay, so if I'm listening to something that's extremely testosterone fueled, let's say, you know, some hardcore heavy doom metal or something, does that increase my, you know, my sexual tension, my desire to have sex? Does it increase my desire to take drugs? I mean, that's really what they're looking at in this article. And I guess I was more fascinated with the scope and the depth that they went into to try to pull out something that we've just sort of tossed off as just a cultural, dude, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, let's go. Yeah.
They did. They looked at different genres of music. And, you know, when we talk about rock and roll, we talked about this in the last podcast, what we thought rock and roll or rock music is. It's, you know, guitar based with drums, real drums and bass guitar, maybe some keyboards, a flashy lead singer, that sort of thing. But they're looking like at hip hop, they're looking at techno, they're looking at punk, they're looking at, you know, death metal and what we would call rock and roll, just sort of maybe hard rock. And then going down the list, even down to soft rock. And of course, what you would probably guess is that the softer the music, like if you're listening to Dan Fogelberg and the leader of the band or something, you're probably not going to be like, you know, the sex and drugs kind of person.
Hey, the leader of the band is tired and his eyes are growing cold, okay? Or old or something to that effect. But you know what, Ted, I without trying to go at this particular study, there was a few issues I had with the idea that you can make the assumption that the harder and nastier the music is, the more you know, our sexual proclivities, you know, become more intense, or our desire to do drugs and engage in behavior that's not safe or you know, tolerated in some sectors of society. There, can we just look at something like Marvin Gaye's Sexual Healing for 1 minute?
Okay.
Came out when you and I were in high school, 1982. Mm-hmm. I get so horny when I hear that song, and there is nothing, there's not even any real drums in that song, Ted. There's that's a drum machine. And that's towards the end of Marvin Gaye's career. You know, before he was unfortunately shot by his father 2 years after that record came out. But the reality is I don't know if we can put something in a genre and then say, well, the harder, the nastier, the faster, the louder, the more sex and drugs is going to get involved. I think plenty of people are having sex to Sexual Healing. They may even be doing drugs during that. I don't know. I think it may have more to do with the song's vibe itself than a genre.
I think you're right. I think that there are certain songs that will put you in a mood or the mood. And then there are certain ones, like, I mean, you think about it, like you're on a first or second date, maybe even a third date with someone, and you decide, well, let me just fire it up on my phone, some, you know, death metal. That's aggressive music, right? I mean, wouldn't that just be a mood killer like right away? But I think what these professors are looking at is the culture of these genres. And when people go to these concerts, if you will, you know, I mean, really, that's what it is. It's when you get together with a group that the intensity increases. And so the likelihood that you're going to maybe imbibe in some, you know, illicit substances and maybe hook up with somebody.
It's the shared experience you're describing that creates that mood that may lead to, like the study describes, imbibing in illegal substances and engaging in sexual activity.
So as you came at this from your teacher's perspective, if you gave this article to your students, for example, because they may find it interesting, not only from what they're studying, but just as from their cultural point of view, you know, because many of your students, I'm sure, like rock music, like hip hop, like techno, like a wide variety of music. But what do you suppose the reaction would be if you gave them this as sort of supplemental reading?
Well, what's interesting is there is a part of the curriculum where they are asked to bring a cultural, video or a song or song lyrics that describe the sexual relationship that they have with a partner, current or former, or maybe future fantasy partner. And I typically get turned in assignments that feature, yes, some hip hop, yes, some sort of slow romantic ballads. I have yet to have anybody turn in like something from, you know, black metals, you know, We Are All Going to Die, or the Blood and Vomit record or something. Based on the 3 years I've been teaching the class and the different assignments people have turned in with regard to what are kind of cultural things or songs or vibes or music that you attach to sexuality. And again, just purely based on my own experience with my own students, it's been not leaving a lot to the imagination kinds of songs, no matter what genre they happen to be in. I think my students would find this fascinating, but I think that they would, based on every student I've so far had in this course over 3 years, they're less concerned about genre than they are about mood, about lyrics, about intent. And that's typically what people feed back to me. It's like, when I play this song, I'm going to jump my husband the minute he walks in the door. And that tends to be what I get back from them when it comes to how does music relate to sex. I'm still waiting. Where is my punk couple that's going to turn in something that's, you know, that they're basing it on aggressive feeling, not just lyrics that you can't ignore the meaning of.
I'm looking at the cover of Rolling Stone magazine for February 2021, and on the cover is Dua Lipa. And Dua Lipa is wearing this sort of cut-up fishnet outfit. It's, you know, very revealing, and she's got a very revealing pose. And I'm looking at the last edition, had Miley Cyrus with basically topless. She was covering up her breasts, but Rolling Stone knows what sells, right? Sex sells. And looking at this picture, I'm like, well, of course I'm going to pick it up because, well, who is that? Oh, it's Dua Lipa. Let me read more about her and let's see what the photo shoot looks like and so forth. So it's almost like a way in which the industry, whether it's overt love songs or Rolling Stone magazine that can put a picture of a very attractive woman performer on the cover to sell magazines. It's part of the culture, and it gets to, and I guess my question is from your perspective as a teacher of human sexuality, why are we so attracted to this stuff?
When you ask that question, Ted, I still shoot ahead to the whole concept of where have we grown? Where have we progressed in that department? Because if you think back on, you know, the whole sex sells concept, I mean, there are things that you just don't do anymore in the Me Too movement, nor should you. And some people on the right will call that cancel culture. I just call that evolution, you know, moving forward and accepting people for who they are and not just how they look or how they perform. I'm looking at some of the deeper dives we take into bands that 20 or 30 years ago, we would have gotten away with all kinds of stuff. The lyrics bands got away with on just regular pop radio that you and I heard, things you can't do anymore and you can't say anymore, nor maybe should you. That's become part of the same discussion that we're having now. There's a reason that Rob Halford, the lead singer of one of the heaviest metal bands of the 70s and 80s and maybe 90s too, Judas Priest, who was gay, didn't come out, you know, in 1985 when they were performing at Live Aid, right? The evolution of our society has also affected the evolution of sexuality and music.
All right. Now that makes sense. That makes sense. I kind of look at, like I use Rolling Stone as an example because they're trying to position themselves as still a relevant magazine.
Right. And fairly cutting edge. I think they think of themselves as being, you know, ahead of the curve and ahead of the, of conservatism, and they're progressive. And I feel like that's what they think they are.
But I think prior to this year, their covers have really featured mostly aging boomer rock acts, you know, like they'll put Springsteen on the cover, or they'll put, you know, Dylan on the cover. It's always people from a particular era, but now it seems like they're shifting focus. It's like they're realizing, oh, you know what? As we talked about in our last cast about Is Rock Dead, the old farts are going to be dying off soon. We better try to get a current demographic, like, you know, between 25 and 40, that is going to buy our magazine again. So we need to put attractive people back on the cover of these magazines or of the editions.
Right. And maybe a question we should be asking is that okay? Is it okay? Are we objectifying Dua Lipa and Miley Cyrus, or are the magazines and the culture and that's buying the magazines, are we saying, no, they're beautiful, they're talented, I want to see the photo spread inside, I want to follow up on the music? I think those are the questions that in my human sexuality class I'm asking my students to think about. It's, are we reverting back to the time in the 70s where, yes, sex sells, so let's throw, you know, female sexuality everywhere to sell to a bunch of horny dudes? Or have we progressed? Are we accepting people of face value? Do we accept people from all walks of life and all parts of every community? And we're just celebrating beauty where we find it.
Is that like sex positive? Is that what they call it?
Yeah, they do call it sex positive, and I'm all for sex positivity. I'm concerned that as we look at things like, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, it said there's sort of an ugly side to that that is always, maybe I was a frightened young man, was afraid to try drugs and was afraid to have sex, and, you know, but still wanted to rock. So you know what I mean? There was a negative connotation, and I'm just, as I pose that question to my students, I pose it to you too. Is it okay that we're finding beauty? And if it happens to be, you know, a gorgeous 25-year-old singer like Dua Lipa, that's okay. Or are we objectifying? And sometimes I'm not sure what the answer is. And that's why I throw it to my students to make them think a little bit.
I don't think there is any easy answer to that question, is there?
That's the sex, drugs, and rock and roll part, Ted. And before we drift too far away from that, I've got to say this too. You and I, again, I love talking to a guy who grew up the same years that I did, because you don't have to go, who are the Allman Brothers? What is he talking about?
Our birthdays are like a week apart, I believe.
That's what I mean. Yeah. And Ted, you know as well as I do, there was some amazing, I mean, amazing music recorded in the 70s when allegedly everybody was stoned, everybody was super high on extreme narcotics, everybody was effing everybody. And I keep thinking to myself, now as a musician myself, and I'm no Greg Allman, I'm no Eric Clapton, but I know for a fact you can't be completely zoned out of your mind and do and produce work like, even with editing and you know, behind the scenes stuff, things like Live at the Fillmore or any of some of those amazing records or performances you and I saw growing up. So I wonder how much of it is mythical and is a mythical trilogy versus were these people, and we know some of them really had major substance abuse problems and screwed a lot of people, but there's some of it, I just wonder how much of that is real when it comes to actual performance, actual rock and roll creation. You know, David Lee Roth, are you really drinking 7 pints of Jack Daniels before you go out there and do Jump? I mean, yeah, maybe every now and again, but there's too much good work there for you all to have been sex, drugs, and rock and rolling all the time.
Yeah, is the Jack Daniels really iced tea, right? You know, for the photo shoot. Right.
I only posed that because I think as a kid who was afraid of drugs growing up, and although I wasn't afraid to have sex, I was, didn't think I'd be very good at it. And girls were intimidating to me, but I wanted to rock. I was in a band when I was 13 and I kept thinking I can barely do that. My nerves are bad enough getting in my way of a great performance. I can't imagine if I'd had, you know, smoked 4 doobies with all my buddies and had 4 Mickey's Big Mouths. And then I was like, yeah, it would have been just a disaster. Now for certain musical genres, black metal, doom metal, maybe that's okay. But you're not going to record, you know, I don't know, the live version of YYZ if you're Rush, if you're absolutely off. I don't know if it's biologically possible.
I had that same view of when I read a biography. It wasn't, I don't think it was authorized, but it was a biography about Pete Townsend. And he went through a pretty bad period after Keith Moon's death. So from the release of Empty Glass to The Who's last album in the 80s, it's hard. I mean, he produced basically, there was 2 Who albums and 2 solo albums in that period. Yet, during that period, he was completely lost in booze and heroin. I mean, he had a heroin addiction that he tried to get. He got out of it. But during that period was an incredibly creative period. And I was reading this. I'm like, how the hell does somebody do that? How are you either so drunk that you can barely stand up or so like dosed with heroin that you could barely stay awake, but yet produce this amount of material? Because it wasn't in the vaults. This is the stuff that he was writing fresh.
Right. And I think, you know, when we describe those types of rockers, I mean, Eric Clapton, famously addicted to heroin and an alcoholic and all kinds of stuff during some of the most creative years of his career in the 70s. I think those performers are on a different level, not just maybe physically with their abilities and that kind of genius. I mean, John Lennon had it, and even he was addicted to all kinds of stuff and was able to create, but they've also got handlers and producers and people to go in and fix what they've screwed up. And if they're just like, you know, man, I'm so drunk, but I come up with this idea, you know, and then someone will come in and take the idea and publish it and clean it up and get, you know, seven session musicians to suss it out in the studio before. So, but I guess I'm thinking of the bands that are maybe one or two tiers lower than that, that have bought into the myth of, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's why I got into the business. I just think, just based on my knowledge base, I don't know how long you'll stay in the business. You know, hello, Guns N' Roses on the phone for you. How long did that thing, you know what I mean? I just wonder, and there were so many other bands like them in LA at the time. I mean, oh my God, who remembers Paradise? Pair-A-Dice.
I do not.
There was a million of those bands just because I was in the scene at that time. And the sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing only works maybe if you are Eric Clapton or you are Pete Townsend. You've got $7 million a minute to spend on cleaning up your weird messes while you create stuff.
I guess so. But then you have the tragedies, right? The people that they just go whole hog and it's pretty much over early.
Jimi Hendrix on line three, please. Jimi Hendrix, line three.
Hey man, this is Jimmy. What's going on,
doing, man? I think of what you would have done if you lived past 27. I mean, Kurt Cobain. We could go on. It's crazy.
Yeah, but I'm not alive, man. You're calling a direct line.
I'm talking to Jimi Hendrix right now because when Gene Simmons invaded our last podcast, it's nice that he's not the only one who will sneak into these things and make themselves known. That's nice. Thank you, Tim.
No, man, Gene Simmons, man, that's a copycat cat.
Let's not forget, Jimmy, that I actually pioneered the whole kabuki makeup thing and turned it into something very profitable. Something that you wouldn't know because you were doing drugs and you died too early to enjoy all the fruits of your labor. So,
and all I did is invert a baseline from the Rolling Stones. If they went up, I went down. I figured it was going to make money either way, right?
Right. It's all about the fans.
It's always been about the fans, John. Always.
And there's a guy talk about the opposite of everything we're talking about. There's a guy other than the sex part, but I mean, clearly not a drug user, right?
Never. Although he says he's never really touched the stuff because he felt like it was just, you're wasting your life doing it. We should talk about Kiss the next time and talk about the books that were written by the members, because it's a fascinating sort of glimpse into what it was like to be at that level of a rock star and have that much money and that much cocaine or whatever the hell you wanted, women, and what it did to at least two of the four members. That might be a good conversation for next time.
Absolutely. And it dovetails nicely into the concept of how are sex, drugs, and rock and roll part of this, what they call mythical or magical trilogy that Harrison and Hughes described. It's mythic. And I just feel like there's multiple angles there.
Yeah. The storied trilogy.
Storied trilogy. Thank you.
Well, John, we have reached the end of the line once again at the end of the segment. And as always, I am thrilled to have you on the Rooks and Beckards podcast.
It is always a pleasure. Ted Ezrigato, I love you, buddy. Thanks again for having me.
Oh, so much love in the room. Okay, that's the show. Hey, did you know that you can subscribe to the Rooks and Beckards podcast? Yep. If you get your podcast through Apple, we're there. How about iHeartRadio? Yes, we're there too. And here are some other places you can subscribe. Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Amazon, or Spotify. See, wherever you listen to podcasts, the Rooks and Beckards podcast is probably listed. I try to post new episodes every Monday. Thanks again for listening. I'm Ted, and I'll be back soon to talk more about books and records.